It has been a marketing campaign, in our view, not a an actual effort to stop this process. And they would argue that it is, there's millions of products and it's a whack-a-mole type process to try to stop this. Well, you can right now go to Amazon.com and start searching for essential products and find price gouging. This is not a whack-a-mole. This is a pervasive problem. And they're doing nothing. And so the only conclusion we can draw is they either don't care or there is a profit motivation here. And it is important to note, we were focused on Amazon as the seller, but they have arguably a greater profit motivation when it is a third-party seller engaging in this. And so the fact that third-party sellers are continuing and Amazon themselves are doing this suggests that they do not see this as a problem because they are looking to maximize profit during the pandemic.
Alex Harmon, we want to thank you for being with us with Public Citizen, author of the new report, Prime Gouging, How Amazon Raised Prices to Profit from the Pandemic. And that does it for our show. We'll link to that at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Noreen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us. Wear a mask. Stay safe.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio wants to know what you care about this election season. We want to ask our listeners one simple question. What do you think candidates should be talking about as they compete for votes? Let us know by filling out our Citizens Agenda survey, and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa prepaid gift card. The responses we get from our community will inform our reporting on the November election. We want our coverage to serve our community, and we need your help to make it happen. If you would like to participate and be entered to win $50, go online to bit.ly/KBOOSurvey. Again, that's bit.ly/KBOOSurvey.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a program director to manage our programming department. This full-time position requires proven experience in program directing, radio audio production, management, and supervisory skills with volunteers, with an emphasis on teamwork and a collaborative setting, and the ability to work under strict deadlines. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. The deadline to apply for this position is Saturday, October 3rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm/employment.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Multiple wildfires continue to burn in the Portland metro and surrounding areas. The city of Louisville, Kentucky has agreed to a settlement in the police killing of Breonna Taylor. And a whistleblower complaint accuses ICE facilities of medical neglect and unnecessarily high rates of hysterectomies. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 15th, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Multiple wildfires continue to burn throughout the Portland metro and surrounding areas. Two huge fires, the Beachy Creek Fire in Marion County and the Riverside Fire in Clackamas County, have burned more than 324,000 acres as of Tuesday morning. Officials said this week that the two fires remain about 1 mile apart and a merger of the two is not an imminent threat. As of Tuesday morning, 35 active wildfires have burned more than 838 acres throughout the state. Last week, Governor Kate Brown said that more than 40,000 Oregonians had been forced to evacuate and an estimated 500,000 people statewide were under some level of evacuation orders due to the wildfires. A dense smoke advisory also remains in effect in the region through Wednesday, and an air quality alert is in effect for the entire states of Oregon and Washington through Thursday. Thanks to steadfast firefighting efforts and increasingly favorable weather conditions, more accurate statistics regarding Oregon wildfire casualties are showing lesser human fatalities than initially documented. Reports of human deaths have been reduced to 10, largely due to misidentified remains, which were confused with animal remains amidst the thick coat of smoke that has enveloped the area. 22 people are still unaccounted for in the state, specifically in Jackson, Lane, and Marion counties. Determining factors suggest those individuals may be displaced due to last week's evacuation orders. More than 1 million homes have been devastated throughout the state since extreme weather conditions ignited many fires over the Labor Day weekend throughout Oregon, which has joined Washington and California in unprecedented intensity and fire damage for the year. The smoky air that has been enveloping the skies of the West Coast due to recent historic wildfires has a prominent effect on public health. Suzanne Potter has more with the Public News Service.
Public health experts say smoke from the wildfires that's choking California's skies carries dangerous levels of particulate matter. Studies show that firestorms drive a spike in visits to the emergency room, especially among the elderly. Dr. Janice Kirsch is a medical oncologist trained in public health. She says the toxins in the smoke can cause serious damage.
Breathing these particulates can cause or exacerbate heart disease, respiratory disease, lung cancer, and probably other cancers. Prolonged repeated exposure leads to dementia and other behavioral problems in children.
Kirsch says indoor air quality can be almost as bad as it is outdoors, so she advises people to use an air purifier and turn on the air conditioner if you have one to improve circulation. If you have to go outside, she says N95 masks are effective, but the cloth masks people wear for protection against the coronavirus will not stop particulate matter. Groups that fight climate change say the extreme drought, heat, and wildfires are symptoms of a bigger problem. Kathy Durbin with the nonprofit 350 Bay Area says global warming is a public health emergency that demands rapid and transformative solutions.
We have great goals for clean electricity, for cleaner fuels, for cleaner transportation, but we really need to front load those changes and not wait until the goal of 2045. We don't have any time to wait.
In 2018, California lawmakers passed Senate Bill 100, which set a goal of 100% clean energy by 2045. Now advocates say the state has made so much progress that they're calling for a new deadline of 2030. They say the ultimate goal of net zero emissions will depend on getting gasoline-powered cars off the road and on switching homes and businesses to clean energy instead of natural gas. Natural gas is problematic because pipelines often leak methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Two members of the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office have given false information as to the cause of fires in the area. In a video circulating on social media, the deputies falsely claim that Antifa is to blame for some of the wildfires. KBOO's Al Kahn has more.
An unidentified Clackamas County Sheriff's deputy has been placed on administrative leave after a video was posted online claiming the fires in the area were started by Antifa activists. The video shows the deputy using an expletive not suitable for the public airwaves as he said, quote, "Antifa mother are out causing hell, and there's a lot of lives at stake, and there's a lot of property at stake, because these guys got some vendetta," end quote. The deputy's statements run contradictory to information coming from Clackamas County Sheriff Craig Roberts, who has stated there is no evidence that Antifa is to blame for the fires. This is not the only misinformation coming from the Sheriff's Department, however. In a Thursday briefing to the Clackamas County Commissioners, Captain Jeff Smith incorrectly reported there was credible reports of extremists in the county starting fires and committing acts of sabotage. During the briefing, which was being held in part to discuss implementing a countywide curfew, Smith said the Sheriff's Office had received reports of extremist groups staging gas cans in the area to be used for later destruction, and reports of people with chainsaws, whose goal was to fall telephone poles in hoping of starting further fires. Smith is quoted as saying, "It's not confirmed Antifa, but it's suspected Antifa." Over the past weeks, there have been several posts on social media blaming both the far left and the far right of causing fires throughout the area, sparking groups of vigilantes setting up illegal roadblocks in evacuation areas. Just hours after Smith's briefing, Armin stopped a reporter for Oregon Public Broadcasting in Malala and ordered him to leave the area. And near Estacada, independent photojournalist Nathan Howard was also detained by a group of men accusing him of being a looter and was forced to leave as the men pointed rifles at him. The FBI in Portland has investigated these rumors and found them to be false. Government and law enforcement officials across Oregon and Washington have asked the public to stop spreading misinformation. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
The rumors that have been circulating about Antifa arson as the cause of the historic wildfires in Oregon are false. Antifa is not a coordinated organization, but rather an ideology that opposes fascism. Fire officials have been clear about what is driving most of the wildfires in Oregon, namely a combination of existing drought conditions, high temperatures, a once-in-a-century windstorm, and downed power lines due to the wind. Residential garbage recycling and compost collection will be delayed this week in the Portland area due to hazardous air quality. The Portland Bureau of Planning and Sustainability says residents with pickups scheduled between Monday, September 14th and Friday the 18th should leave their carts out and they will be picked up as soon as it is safe to do so. They added that collection could possibly occur on Saturday. The Bureau also said that garbage and compost pickup will be prioritized, so there is a chance that recycling will not be emptied until next week. The City of Vancouver has also said that regular garbage and recycling services would be delayed due to the unsafe weather conditions. Customers with questions are urged to contact their local garbage and recycling company. Alaska Airlines has temporarily suspended all flights in and out of the Portland International Airport due to heavy layers of wildfire smoke still blanketing the region. The 12-hour suspension began at 3 p.m. Monday afternoon, with hopes of lifting the stall on Tuesday. A similar cancellation has been issued for flights to Spokane and all Horizon Air flights. Other airports in Oregon are also affected by the flight disruption, including Eugene, Bend, and Medford. A spokesperson from Alaska Airlines said, quote, "We made the difficult decision to stop our operation so that our employees and guests remain safe. Travelers affected by the disruption can change or cancel reservations under Alaska's Peace of Mind waiver online or by calling the airline directly at 1-800-252-7522. The Oregon Health Authority reported 184 new cases of COVID-19 on Tuesday, bringing the state's total number of cases up to 29,962. Oregon health officials also reported 8 new deaths, raising the total death toll in the state up to 519. Multnomah County again had the highest number of new cases on Tuesday with 35, followed by Marion County with 31 and Malheur and Washington counties with 25 new cases each. Nationally, as of Tuesday afternoon, more than 6.6 million people in the U.S. have been infected with COVID-19. At least 195,000 people have died across the country. Over the past week, there have been an average of about 36,000 cases per day, a decrease of 12% from the average 2 weeks earlier. Democratic Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi of California, said on Tuesday that the House would not leave for the November elections without acting on an additional round of stimulus to aid the coronavirus-ravaged economy. Her statement came just before a bipartisan group of 50 centrist lawmakers planned to present a $1.5 trillion stimulus plan as a last-ditch effort to revive stalled talks between Democrats and the White House. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 29.3 million people in nearly every country. At least 930,000 people have died across the world. You're listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with the Pacific Seafarers Coalition about seafarers stranded at sea due to COVID-19. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, it's Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be smoky with a low of 62 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high of 79 degrees. The National Weather Service has extended the dense smoke advisory for the Portland area through noon on Wednesday, while the air quality advisory will remain in effect until noon on Thursday. Today in history, in 1978, boxer Muhammad Ali defeats Leon Spinks at the Louisiana Superdome in New Orleans, winning the world heavyweight boxing title for the third time in his career and becoming the first fighter ever to do so. The quote of the day is from Muhammad Ali, speaking about the Vietnam War. Ali said, quote, "The real enemy of my people is here. I will not disgrace my religion, my people, or myself by becoming a tool to enslave those who are fighting for their own justice, freedom, and equality." The city of Louisville, Kentucky, has agreed to a settlement in the death of Breonna Taylor. For more, we go to KBOO's Al Kahn.
The city of Louisville, Kentucky, has agreed to pay the family of Breonna Taylor a $12 million settlement in a wrongful death lawsuit. This is the largest amount the city has ever paid in such a case. Included in the agreement are several new police reforms, such as changing the approval process and execution of search warrants, hiring social workers, and increased testing of police officers involved in shootings for drugs and alcohol. Taylor was killed in her apartment on March 13th when police executed a no-knock search warrant looking for drugs and money in connection to an investigation of her former boyfriend. Breonna was home in bed after working a 12-hour shift as an EMT when police used a battering ram to break down the door. Her current boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, was there with her. Walker, who has a legal permit for a firearm, shot once, injuring an officer before police opened fire, shooting Taylor five times, killing her. Walker was taken into custody on charges of attempted murder, but has since been released and the charges have been dismissed. None of the three officers involved in the raid has been charged with the crime as of yet, although one, Brett Hankerson, was fired in late June for blindly firing 10 shots into the apartment. The death of Taylor, which came on the heels of the killings of Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd, led to widespread protests both in Louisville and nationwide. Since her death, the Louisville police chief has been fired in connection with a separate police shooting, and the city council passed a law banning no-knock search warrants, dubbed Breonna's Law. Earlier this year, Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron, who is the first African-American to hold the position, was made a special prosecutor in the case, and the FBI has also opened an investigation. Also, a grand jury has been impaneled to look into the shooting, though there is currently no information available regarding these proceedings. Neither the Louisville Police nor the Police Officers Union have made any comment about the settlement. For KBOO News, I'm Al Kahn.
A whistleblower who previously worked as a nurse at an Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in Georgia has alleged medical neglect and high rates of hysterectomies in a complaint filed to the Department of Homeland Security Inspector General on Monday. Don Wooten, a licensed practical nurse who was being represented by the Government Accountability Project and Project South, stated in a complaint that while some women may have required a hysterectomy, quote, "Everybody's uterus cannot be that bad." The facility at the center of the complaint is the Irwin County Detention Center. LaSalle Corrections, which operates the facility, has not yet commented on the allegations. The complaint also includes a series of concerns about the facility's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. They include treating coronavirus symptoms with over-the-counter cold medication, lack of social distancing, and transfers of detainees despite heightened risk of spreading the virus. According to ICE statistics, there have been 43 total confirmed cases of COVID-19 at the Irwin County Detention Center. Nationwide, there have been more than 5,799 cases overall at ICE detention centers. The allegations raised in the complaint are similar to those surfacing around the country from immigrants held at ICE facilities, according to court documents, lawyers, and other whistleblowers. The Green Party ticket of Howie Hawkins and Angela Walker will not be on Wisconsin's ballot. And Trump got a briefing on wildfires and climate change from California officials, but his position remains unchanged. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
We want to be on the ballot. We submitted our signatures, and we got challenged by some of the Democrats, and it's a mess.
The Green Party's presidential candidate, Howie Hawkins, and his running mate, labor organizer Angela Walker, will not be on the ballot in Wisconsin. Yesterday, the state's highest court rejected a bid to stop the printing and mailing of ballots to include their names. Approval of their signatures was challenged due to an address discrepancy. When they appealed, the court decided it was too late. Thousands of ballots had already been printed, and they feared adding more confusion to an already chaotic election. Rapper Kanye West didn't make the Wisconsin ballot either. More bad news for the Greens. In a widely shared letter, over 170 prominent environmental activists and scientists urged voters to choose former Vice President Joe Biden over the Green Party this year. There's concern that third-party candidates may siphon votes from Biden and aid Trump. Republican lawyers were involved helping both the Green and West bids to get on the ballot. But Hawkins says Green presidential candidates actually help down-ballot Democrats.
Most of our voters are people that wouldn't vote if we weren't on the ballot. In 2016, the exit poll showed 61% of Jill Stein's voters said they would have stayed home if she was not on the ballot. On the other hand, we bring new voters out who, when they go down the ballot, where they're not Greens running, are more likely to vote for a Democrat than a Republican.
In California, for a briefing on the devastating wildfires, Trump made clear his position on climate is unchanged. He stated, against evidence that shows climate change is heating the planet, quote, it will start getting cooler, end quote, I don't think science knows actually. Biden responded with his harshest remarks on Trump's position on climate change so far, calling Trump a, quote, climate arsonist.
If you have a climate denier 4 more years in the White House, why would anyone be surprised when more of America is underwater? We need a president who respects science, who understands that the damage from climate change is already here.
Biden was in Delaware voting early for their primary today. Delaware's is the country's last. Anticipating voting challenges, the Biden campaign also announced a new legal team, including former Attorney General Eric Holder and two former Solicitors General, to join hundreds of lawyers in protecting the vote, some in legal battles already. In recent testimony to Congress, Kristen Clark with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law listed what's been accomplished so far through the courts or legislation.
Eliminating barriers to voting by mail, putting in place drop boxes that provide opportunities for returning ballots, extending early voting days, relaxing deadlines, hiring a next generation of poll workers, investing in new election infrastructure, and providing voter education.
And Clark's call for more.
But some states have not yet implemented those recommendations, and we urge that they do so immediately.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
An impeachment vote has failed for the Oglala Sioux tribal president. Flags are lowered on Navajo land to honor two Navajo soldiers. And Olympic gold medalist Billy Mills is calling on Congress to reinstate the extended census deadline. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A vote to impeach Oglala Sioux Tribal President Julian Bearrunner failed after a long special tribal council session Monday in South Dakota. The vote was 11 for impeachment, 5 against, and 5 not voting. The motion needed 14 votes to pass. The impeachment hearing, which aired on the radio and was broadcast online, involved allegations against Bearrunner for inappropriate sexual contact with a teenager. The young man, now 18, brought forth the accusations to the council about coerced sexual incidents with Bearrunner, including when he was 17. His mother also testified, saying her son has developmental disabilities. Bearrunner denies the allegations. In his response, Bearrunner told the council they're false, claiming a he-said-she-said argument and calling the impeachment hearing unjust. Bearrunner says there needs to be due process of law through criminal proceedings and that his character has been defamed. Two witnesses testified on the president's behalf. The council went into executive session after the hearing and came back to vote and debated for about 30 minutes before they adjourned. A church in Rapid City, South Dakota, is working with a handful of Native families to provide a space for children to learn during the pandemic. Those involved hope it opens the door to broader reconciliation. Mike Moen has more.
Earlier this month, St. Andrew's Episcopal Church began allowing a homeschool pod that includes 10 Native American students. The Reverend Cody Menes says, given the fact that the church sits on land that was taken away from tribes, they saw it as a good first step in making amends on a broader scale.
We have an opportunity here to not only be a good neighbor, but engage in some justice work.
He hopes it leads to more connections and easing of tension between natives and non-natives in Rapid City amid larger bridge-building efforts by other groups in the community. One of those groups, MOA, has been focused on the issue through projects such as An Inconvenient Truth. It documents stolen Native American land through a congressional act in western Rapid City several decades ago. MOA Director Karen Mortimer says ideally, they would like to work out a complete land swap between the city and tribes in the form of reparations. In the meantime, she says gestures such as the one from the church go a long way.
It's not solving the problem, but it's opening it up to look for solutions.
Those behind the reparations effort have been engaged with the city in discussing how to address these parcels of land. While it's unclear what that might look like, those talks could reemerge at city council meetings as early as next month.
That was Mike Moen. Navajo Nation leaders have issued a proclamation calling for flags on the reservation to be flown at half-staff Tuesday in honor of two soldiers who died while stationed at Fort Hood. Carlton Chi and Miguel Yazzie, both Navajo, recently died at the Texas base. Navajo leaders have called on U.S. lawmakers for a thorough investigation into the deaths. The men are among 28 people who've died at Fort Hood this year. Tribal leaders have been in contact with Fort Hood officials and family members. A burial service is being held Tuesday in Gallup, New Mexico for Chi. Yazzie's service has already been held. Olympic gold medalist and Native advocate Billy Mills is calling for the 2020 census deadline to be reinstated to October 31st. Mills delivered more than 2,000 signatures on the issue to the U.S. Senate Tuesday. Mills says the census is a valuable tool for change and representation in Indian country, adding Native communities deserve to be counted. COVID-19 has hit tribal communities hard and has hindered census activity. The deadline for the census was moved to the end of September. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Kahn and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. Host Paul Rowland speaks with wildland fire ecologist and co-founder and executive director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology, Timothy Inglesby. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Food Show. Emily Becker welcomes Jake Baez, host of Margin Podcast, and Jenny Lay, an experienced manager in the advertising industry, to discuss growing up as the children of immigrants, food memories, and how culture does not exist in a vacuum. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. We're currently in our fall membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Ready to work. Ready.
Okay, why don't you take a turn and then I'll take a turn. What do you want to record?
Well, why can't people get off of the cargo ships?
Yes, that's a very interesting question. Over 300,000 seafarers are trapped at sea on the cargo ships where they work. They're unable to go ashore because of COVID restrictions. Their contracts usually last 9 or 10 months. Many have now been at sea for a year or a year and a half. Jessie Braverman is an organizer with the Pacific Coast Coalition of Seafarers. She says conditions on the boats are getting worse, creating an international human rights crisis.
My name is Jessie Braverman. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I organize with the Pacific Coast Coalition for Seafarers.
And what is the Pacific Coast Coalition for Seafarers?
The Pacific Coast Coalition for Seafarers officially launched on the International Day of the Seafarer, which was in June of this year. And we launched after months of work between allied trade unions, migrant and human rights organizations to respond to the neglect of seafarers' most basic needs by shipping companies and their home governments during the COVID pandemic. And even while seafarers are frontline workers, they remain some of the most exploited workers in the world and are kept invisible to anyone outside of the maritime industry. And so this is why the coalition's mission is to really build that unity between land and sea and communities in solidarity with seafarers. As the seafarers are uniting to act as one, making demands of their home governments, ship owners, and manning agencies to stand up for their rights, it's so crucial for all of us on land to unite alongside them and amplify their voice and demand to ensure their dignity, rights, and welfare to be heard around the world.
How have seafarers been impacted by COVID-19?
Yeah, so about 1.6 million seafarers worldwide who work in cargo ships, cruise, fishing boats, oil rigs, and others are among the hardest hit by the COVID-19 pandemic. And more than 300,000 seafarers are stranded at sea because lockdowns in different countries have prevented them from leaving ships when they arrive at port, or even from flying home after their contracts have ended. There has been an international ban based on crew changes, and so seafarers who were out at sea during the start of the pandemic were not able to return home even if their contracts were up. And shipping companies have been taking advantage of this situation and making changes to workers' contracts. And so a lot of seafarers are being forced to extend their contracts, which were already almost, 9 or 10 months long, and continue working throughout the pandemic because there has not been a prompt response from shipping companies or even their home governments to help seafarers return home safely. And with the coalition, we've been visiting ships through the pandemic to deliver much needed supplies to seafarers to help meet their basic needs that have been neglected. And we've been meeting workers who have been on ships for as long as like 14 to 17 months now without any communication on when they'll be able to return home to their families. Seafarers generally make very low wages. And even through the pandemic, they're not being paid hazard pay if they continue to work 60 hours per week. And actually this week, we also received word that the ship that's on its way to Portland right now has a crew of Filipino seafarers who are not being given any clean drinking water by their captain. And this is not uncommon, as especially during the pandemic, many workers are stranded at sea without enough food or drinking water. Some days the only thing left for them to eat are onions. And because they lack the clean water to drink, a lot of them have resorted to getting water dripping from air conditioners or faucets. We've also been hearing that a lot of them don't have regular access to the internet while they're on shift, so they actually have no way to communicate with their families back home to let them know they won't be returning when they expected them. And some ship owners are now even asking managers to cut the internet while they're at sea, so seafarers can't share tactics on how to best affect crew changes by stopping work. And in some of the most extreme cases, because of this intense crisis that the seafarers are currently facing, there have been multiple cases of workers committing suicide while at sea. Because of the hopelessness, the fear, and exhaustion they're facing thousands of miles away from home in some of the harshest conditions you could imagine, essentially invisible to the rest of the world.
What makes it so difficult for some seafarers to get home?
Yeah, so we're seeing that the countries with the highest number of seafarers also are countries with a very low level of industrial infrastructure. So governments of these countries are refusing to repatriate or bring back their seafarers home on the basis that they don't have the industrial capacity to receive and triage them. Yet behind this reality is a very deliberate neglect of comprehensive socioeconomic development in favor of foreign-owned corporations. So whole communities are without power and clean drinking water, and yet the government invests in power plants and water management for mines and ports designed to export raw materials and products out of the country. So in short, what these countries are lacking is a homegrown national industrialization, and this is not an accident, as corrupt bureaucrats in the government pass laws that favor their family companies while keeping the economy in a backward state to attract loans and foreign capital to line their own pockets. And for example, like the Philippines, whose economy relies on exporting its own people, has been neglecting calls for repatriation because the government profits off of taxes on remittances from its overseas workers. So we're seeing a profound conflict of interest along class lines, as the business-owning class that makes up the majority of their government relies on workers to seek jobs outside of the poorly industrialized Philippine economy so that their remittances are sent home. And if Filipino seekers raise their voices to fight for their rights, the government has repressive mechanisms in place to silence them. President Duterte, who's the president of the Philippines, just passed what is called an anti-terror law, giving sweeping powers to the executive branch of the government to define who is a terrorist and detain people without warrant. And so if the seeker were to speak out, they could be branded a terrorist, and they or their families back home could be arrested or even killed. And a recent upsurge in assassinations of activists in the Philippines shows the really horrific truth of this reality for all working people trying to hold their government accountable.
What could governments do to address this issue?
Yeah, so the overarching demand that seafarers are currently making of their governments is for repatriation back to their home countries. You know, people are safest with their families and communities, and the circulation of goods should not take priority over workers' lives. In the words of international maritime unions, enough is enough, and it's the responsibility of governments to care for the health and well-being of their overseas workers. And when repatriated, workers should receive appropriate and comprehensive medical and mental health services upon their return home. They should receive fair compensation and appropriate protection from lost wages based on their contract. And with more ships expected to be infected and to dock all over the world, their home governments must be ready to receive and support repatriating seafarers. And the pandemic is really revealing that existing policies, laws, and regulations, both on the national and international level, with objectives to grant basic rights and protection to seafarers worldwide, are clearly inadequate and very weak. And so the challenge ahead is for all of us to contribute to building and organizing a grassroots global movement of seafarers and their families, seafarers' missions, advocates, and unions, strengthen and advance the voices and leadership of seafarers for their lives, livelihood, and health.
Have there been any cases of COVID outbreaks at sea?
Yes, there have been cases of COVID outbreaks at sea, most notably in the U.S. with the Grand Princess cruise ship, which docked in Oakland, California on March 9th of this year, after an outbreak of COVID-19 infections was confirmed. And although passengers and crew members were evacuated when the ship docked, over 600 workers remained on board when it pushed back out from port and remained in the San Francisco Bay. Grand Princess had not tested all members for COVID-19 when the ship docked in Oakland on the 9th, but despite 21 confirmed cases on the cruise ship, 19 of which were actually crew members. And so while measures to disembark passengers were immediately attended to, the migrant workers of the cruise were kept aboard the ship and were treated with less concern and dignity than the passengers who were disembarked first. Carnival and other lines have really routinely failed to employ the most health protective approach when managing this crisis for their workers and their passengers during the public health crisis.
And how many Oregon families are impacted by having a family member stranded at sea?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's so few U.S. seafarers left, actually, as the maritime industry relies so heavily on migrant labor. And U.S. seafarers have better protection through their citizenship. They have access to visas and all the medical protections, while the vast majority of seafarers from the global south do not have access to these same protections. The Patriot Act and other laws affecting immigration have made it easier to exploit migrant labor, leading to the situation today in which there are so few U.S. seafarers. So we know that a quarter of the workforce of the global maritime industry is actually made up of Filipino workers, and this is because they have been made so accessible to the industry to exploit because of the export-dependent economy of the Philippines, which sends so many of its people to work.
And are there any ships that are currently anchored off the shore of Oregon or the West Coast that are no longer working?
Yeah, so regardless of the COVID pandemic, it's actually really common for seafarers to be abandoned by shipping companies if their ships may become broken. Many vessels seafarers work on are older than the average of the rest of the world fleet, and tens of thousands of seafarers endure miserable, life-threatening conditions on substandard vessels, many of them really terribly maintained that should never have even been sailing, often referred to in the industry as like floating coffins. And if ships become broken or companies are in financial trouble, crews are abandoned in foreign ports undocumented and without food or pay. And during the pandemic, there have actually been countless reports of ships capsizing and whole crews gone missing during extreme weather conditions, seafarers being asphyxiated while working on oil tankers, and crews being abandoned by their shipping companies without any access to their most basic needs or plans from countries to bring the crews safely to shore. So the situation is actually becoming increasingly dire as serious seafarer sites are in serious risk.
If listeners are interested in learning more or supporting your organization, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, so we invite folks to donate to our project so we can continue providing much-needed supplies, including SIM cards so seafarers can talk to their families as they're typically not given internet access on ships. And I think most importantly, we invite folks to take action and volunteer with us. We will hold educational events and volunteer days in the future where folks can actually help put together care packages for seafarers and potentially help deliver them depending on our changing conditions during the pandemic. And we'll also hold a really big celebration at the end of the year during the holiday season. And we know seafarers will need our support even after the pandemic, right? And so we hope folks will contact us to get involved for the long term. You can find us on Facebook at Pacific Coast Coalition for Seafarers to stay updated on what we are up to, or just find our GoFundMe page. Or folks can email us directly at pcseafarers@gmail.com.
Do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, I think something really important to nail home is that while seafarers can feel so far away as they are made invisible for the rest of society, on any given day, there are at least 100 seafarers in the Port of Portland working under these incredibly exploitative and dangerous conditions. This is happening in our own backyard, along the river system we care about, and that connects us to migrant workers from around the world. And the Pacific Coast Coalition for Seafarers mission is to build community between land and sea, and communities in solidarity with seafarers. As the seafarers are uniting to act as one, making demands of their home governments, ship owners, and manning agencies to stand up for their rights, all of us on land can also unite alongside them to amplify their voices and demands to ensure their dignity, rights, and welfare are heard around the world. And so I really hope that folks are moved to take action during a time when it is so deeply important. And I'm just so appreciative that you all had me on today to share their story. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for speaking with KBOO today, Jesse.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
On Tuesday, September 15th, members and friends of the Pacific Coast Coalition for Seafarers will hold a community event to call for a pathway for seafarers to return home under COVID. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Brian Oster.
I'm Salima Hamarani, and this is Making Contact.
I honestly don't want to be working right now because I have a 14-year-old who has a compromised immune system.
Not everyone's been able to stay home during the COVID-19 pandemic. Many people considered essential are still going to work even if they don't want to.
There's nothing that I would love more than to be able to stay home and take care of my daughters, but that's just not an option.
we take a look at some of these workers, what we call gig workers or drivers for app companies, and how they're doing economically and physically.
One of the things that is really obvious in both studies that we've done is that these are people who are really living on the edge, sort of paycheck to paycheck.
We also talk about driver organizing as gig workers try to access sick pay, unemployment, and personal protective equipment. So today we're talking about the effect of COVID-19 on a particular type of essential worker, what we call gig workers.
These are people who work for platform-based companies like Uber and Lyft or DoorDash or Instacart.
That's Chris Benner.
I'm a faculty member in the Department of Environmental Studies and Sociology at UC Santa Cruz, and I also direct a research center called the Institute for Social Transformation.
And Chris just published a study.
When the coronavirus crisis hit, we had to put a halt on the survey we were running at that time and really put out a more immediate survey that's trying to understand how the crisis is impacting this workforce of what are often referred to as gig workers.
We wanted to understand whether or not drivers were able to access protective equipment and unemployment and other kinds of benefits because we wanted to know if they were safe. And that's important because, as quote, essential workers, were dependent on their help during quarantine.
I have spoken to many people who use Instacart who ask me to leave the groceries outside, who tell me that their four-year-old has severe asthma, who tell me that their young child just went through a surgery. So I do believe that we are in every way, shape, or form essential. There are people that absolutely cannot go get their groceries.
And that's George Gonzalez.
At the moment, I am an Instacart shopper, so that makes me a gig worker. And I was formerly doing Uber. I still do a little bit of Uber Eats on the side.
We met with George, virtually, of course, to talk about his experiences as a delivery driver. And together, Chris's study and George's personal story tell us that the situation for gig workers during COVID-19 is, well, kind of dangerous for a lot of reasons. Let's start with the study. So, Chris, tell me about how you gathered information. Was it through known drivers groups or online?
We put out a survey and were reaching out through networks of community organizations and labor organizations, as well as closed online Facebook groups. We actually tried at one point to do a sort of open social media-based recruiting strategy, and that survey got hijacked. So we had to sort of work through known networks of drivers.
Wait, Chris, what do you mean it got hijacked?
Well, two things happened. One is someone put in place a bot or algorithm-based process for responding to the survey. So it was just clear that we had a bunch of bad surveys. They were all identical and put in place. So that was the first time. The second time we actually discovered, because someone let us know, that someone was paying people to fill out the survey and giving them email addresses to fill them out, and actually giving very high ratings to the platform company. So we don't know who was behind that, but it was clearly sort of some suspicious responses.
Okay, can you tell me about the demographics you've discovered? Who's working for these apps?
It's a predominantly male workforce. In our survey, it's about 83% were men. A high level of immigrants in the survey, about 50%. Are immigrants. We weren't asking about documentation status, but we can expect that a significant portion of those are undocumented immigrants. Almost 70% were people of color, and over 30% are people with a college degree. It means that 69% have no college degree.
The demographic data tells us that a lot of app drivers need these jobs and aren't able to just stay home and not work, even in the middle of a pandemic. In fact, tracking studies have shown that the wealthy have been able to limit their movement during the shelter-in-place order far more than the poor. Here's George again.
Savings are pretty much impossible doing Uber and Lyft, just because car repairs are always going to be a thing. You know, it's part of what we signed up for, I suppose, as an independent contractor. As far as rent, we're still paying rent here. I pay $1,400 a month in Sacramento. I honestly don't want to be working right now because I have a 14-year-old who has a compromised immune system. So there's nothing that I would love more than to be able to stay home and take care of my daughters, focus on helping them with their homework so that I could quarantine, especially for my 14-year-old's safety, but that's just not an option.
And in fact, he now has to work more than ever because on average, gig worker salaries are tanking.
Most people were losing significant income from before the crisis back in February. And we had some measures that more than half of respondents had actually lost between 75% and 100% of their weekly earnings on the platform companies since February. And the other things that's happened is that with the rapid increase in unemployment, there's a large number of people who've moved in to trying to do that kind of work because at least there's some work there. And so you have essentially a flooded labor market, which means that it's very hard to get enough hours. One of the things that is really obvious in both studies that we've done is that these are people who are really living on the edge, sort of paycheck to paycheck. We have a question in the survey that asks people, you know, whether they have enough resources to handle an emergency expense of only $400. And only 30% roughly of people would be able to pay off immediately a $400 emergency expense. So clearly just one paycheck away from not being able to pay basic bills, utilities and rent, et cetera.
It's very exhausting. We're kind of at the mercy of the people that we're kind of working for. A lot of times we work long hours and we're not getting tipped very well. And that ends up putting us in circumstances where we're making well below minimum wage. I have three daughters. I have a 14-year-old, I have a 6-year-old, and I have a 4-year-old. Kids are very expensive. And it's even harder right now because I have to work more hours to make less, and my kids are not able to go to school right now. So just finding the time to help them with their homework, having to pay for more food, all of this is going down at a time where I'm making less than I've ever made, I think. I have no money. It's been a very difficult circumstance. Going to food banks is something that I never really foresaw in my future, and you know, there's no shame in it, but it's definitely something that my family has counted on. There's a lot of things right now that are not getting paid.
But it's not just the fact that gig workers aren't earning enough that's making their lives difficult at the moment. They also don't have benefits. Benefits which, on paper, exist, but in actuality, are extremely difficult to access.
Large portion of people have no health insurance either, about 17% in the most recent survey, and another 32% are only getting health insurance through some kind of subsidized system through Medi-Cal or Covered California. So even before the coronavirus hit, they're clearly vulnerable. And in general, independent contractors are not eligible for unemployment insurance. Now, with the passage of the Federal CARES Act, independent contractors became eligible for unemployment insurance. But in our survey, we still found quite a number of people who had stopped working and were having a hard time getting unemployment insurance. And, you know, what we've seen is that, you know, nationally over the last 5 weeks, more than 26 million people have filed for unemployment insurance. It's a completely unprecedented scale of jump in that. And many of the, you know, online application systems have been completely overwhelmed. And if they're working and have some income, well, then they're not eligible for unemployment insurance. So they're really in this tricky in-between space that makes them very vulnerable in the current context.
Filing for unemployment seems like a heavy tackle. It's taking a lot of people a long time to get their income. I know that numbers are not guaranteed. And furthermore, there's a long wait to get it. Uber is just one of those difficult things that make it very hard when applying for any kind of help because we are independent contractors. So maybe that's lack of knowledge and I have to take accountability for that. But I also don't feel as though these platforms make it easier on us. I don't feel like they do a good job trying to navigate us toward these healthcare options.
For George, it's too much of a gamble to try and wait for unemployment or other benefits to kick in. He'd rather work now while he's still able to, even if it's extremely dangerous.
I don't want to get backed up. I don't want to start looking for some kind of temporary forgiveness. And then as soon as everything goes back to normal, I have to meet that kind of back payment and continue to make my regular payments. And as it is, it's very scary because once everybody is released back out into the public, who's to say whether or not people are going to want to take Uber.
One of the questions we had going into our interviews was how much responsibility the app companies are taking for their workers. And that was also a big question for Chris in his study.
Part of what we were asking about in this survey is what kind of protections were they getting from the platform companies they're working for to make sure they're being safe and healthy and that they're making sure the customers are being safe and healthy. And I have to say that was one of the most disturbing parts of that is, you know, consistently people were reporting getting very little support from the platform companies themselves. They were taking some more precautions on their own initiatives around wearing gloves or using hand sanitizer, wearing masks.
George, have you contacted the app companies for help with things like masks and gloves?
Yes, I have reached out to Lyft, I have reached out to Uber, and I have reached out to Instacart. In all three circumstances, it's become pretty much impossible. Instacart last week finally allowed me to request an order, and that was last Tuesday, and as of today, I still don't have it. So last Friday in Oakland, they were distributing hand sanitizer and masks. I'm in Sacramento right now because there's no work for me in the Bay Area, and I couldn't drive an hour and 30 minutes just to go get hand sanitizer, so I had to pass up on that. So I called and I stayed on the phone for about 2 hours. I talked to three different people, and finally they said there's nothing we can do regarding getting you a mask in Sacramento. It's extremely hard doing this on our own without any kind of backup from Uber, Lyft, or Instacart.
You know, George made light of his situation a lot, maybe because he had to. He joked about not having any money, for example. But this is where I heard him get kind of angry.
They're not doing a single thing. Every single thing that happens is me. Every time that I spray my car with Lysol, that came out of my budget. Uber did not tell me to do that. They suggested and recommended that I cover my coughs. But every time that we're looking out for our community, that is something that we're doing out of the kindness of our hearts. That is just not something that Uber is doing for them.
Personal protective equipment such as masks, gloves, and disinfectant for millions of drivers would cost a lot of money. But a company like Uber, for example, is valued at least $60 billion. So we reached out to about 10 app companies seeking their comments, but we didn't hear back from them in time. We did, however, go on the websites to check on the new coronavirus updates, and many companies are slowly starting to distribute protective equipment. Though, from the drivers we talked to, it seemed like they've been waiting for a long time, and some drivers had already gotten ill from transporting sick passengers. So we asked Chris what motivated people in his study to keep driving, but we also wanted to know what motivated them to stop driving, given all the economic repercussions that they face.
You know, it's clear that those drivers who stopped working were doing it for essentially two different reasons. One is because there were so few jobs available that it didn't make it possible economically to do it. And second is because, of course, they're afraid of getting exposed to the virus. And I should mention that, you know, ride-hailing drivers in particular are particularly vulnerable because they're giving rides to a lot of people who are traveling, so coming in from different parts of the country, and international flights and potential exposure to, you know, a wide variety of people. And then they're in an enclosed space, their own automobile. We don't have really any data in the country that I know of that gives a breakdown of infection by occupation. We have some data from health workers, but other than that, really not much. But I think we can assume that a lot of people doing this kind of ride-hailing work certainly are disproportionately exposed and potentially higher rates of infection. And what happened quite early on with the pandemic is the platform companies did announce a COVID-19 related paid sick leave for their drivers, but the restrictions around that made it very hard for many drivers to qualify for that. They had to be certified as COVID-19 positive, either themselves or they could do it in some cases for taking care of family members. But we know with the limits in testing that there are many, many people who have had COVID-19 or have it now, including with very serious symptoms, who are not able to get the tests to verify that. And in that case, they would not be eligible for the paid sick leave.
His answer about the rate of COVID infections among drivers stood out to me because I talked to George earlier. And here's what he said when I asked him if he was worried about getting sick.
I believe that I probably had COVID. I was really sick in March. So I had a passenger in the car who told me that her coworker had just caught coronavirus and that they had to send him home. So about 3 days later, I started getting a really bad cough and it turned into pretty violent fevers. I checked my temperature, it was 103.7, but it is by far the most sick I've ever been, which led me to sleep in my car for 2 weeks in San Francisco. And I eventually went to the ER. They did not want to test me for COVID because they said, well, it's been 2.5 weeks. There's no point of giving you a test. Now, I reached out to Uber. I reached out to Lyft to see if they were willing to help me get a test. They did not help me at all. The fact that I am at multiple grocery stores, I do about 6 runs every day, 7 days a week. It is very scary. And I am super afraid of what's going to happen if myself or my daughter were to suffer serious health issues because of COVID. And the fact that very little seems to be getting done in regards to the platforms that make so much money from us.
You were just listening to Chris Benner from the Department of Environmental Studies and Sociology at UC Santa Cruz and the Institute for Social Transformation. You were also listening to George Gonzalez, a driver for Instacart and Uber. We're talking about gig work and essential workers during COVID-19 on today's Making Contact. Make sure you keep up to date on our shows and get behind-the-scenes information on our website, radioproject.org.
Early in this hour, we incorrectly identified the number of homes and structures impacted by recent wildfires. The fire has impacted 1 million acres, not 1 million homes, as we incorrectly stated before. Up-to-date information on your wildfire risk can be found online at wildfire.oregon.gov. Thank you for supporting KBOO, and stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the CWC Walk-In Expungement Clinic on Friday, September 18th from 12 to 6 p.m.